Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. No set schedule, just pretty much whenever I finish a book, I review it and then start the next book. Except, of course, recently where there's been a little time with no podcast at all. But that's mainly because I've not been reading quite so much over the past month or so. You know, after I finished the book that I'm going to review now, it was back in the very end of July, I think it was. And as soon as I finished the book, I was going to review it, but then I turned up at the European Juggling Convention, which is pretty much the largest juggling festival in the world. It runs 9 days, and I was having a lot of fun there and organising a lot of shows as well. One of the two main stages was my responsibility for the full week, so I had to keep a few thousand people happy every night. So while I was there, of course, no podcast recording, but I did do a lot of other stuff, you know, had a lot of fun, managed to break a juggling world record, which you can check on YouTube. Just look for Luke Burridge on YouTube, you can find that. And after that, I had a lot of stuff to do. And since I've been home, I've had a big project. I have actually been spending some time writing some fiction of my own, but my main project is to build a room that can turn upside down. And so when I film myself do it like inside this room, it looks like I'm dancing or juggling on the ceiling. So I'm going to do some shows with that. So yeah, quite a big project there. Not been doing a whole lot of reading, which, to be honest, I could have actually got on and recorded this podcast, this review of this old book, because, like I say, it's been a while since I finished it. But then, of course, the longer it's been, the more I forget about the book. So I keep having to go back and sort of like read the last few pages again, or sort of like just check the notes that I was like keeping when I was reading the book. So this episode, hopefully it won't last too long. But let's just get straight onto it. So the book I'm reading is called The Last Legends of Earth by A.A. Atanasio, or however you pronounce that name. I'll just quickly look in the front where it is from. I'm guessing 1990 this book was published, so it's not a new book. And like I said on the last podcast, I actually remember reading this book before, because there's some, like in the first few chapters, I was reading it just now, I was thinking, oh, I recognise this, I think I understand what's going on here, I think we're working out what's going on here. And then there's this one character said, if Zero could shut its mouth, and that stood out clearly, and I thought, yes, I definitely have read this book before. And there's a story told in the first chapter or so of a mother who is on her deathbed, and her last words are, will I die? And again, that really affected me when I read this back, and I actually wrote a song about or a song using those words, will I die, in while I was at university for one of my music projects there, one of my music assignments. Anyway, so once I got past the first few chapters this time reading it, I couldn't remember anything of the book at all. Maybe it's because I didn't actually finish the book properly last time I read it. Or maybe I read it and just couldn't remember any of it because, well, I don't know, just nothing was coming back to me. But I guess it's the first one. I think the last time I read this book, probably back in 1999 or 1990 or whenever it must have been, I don't know, I reckon I didn't finish it. Because if I had, I'd have remembered it. And to be honest, I wouldn't have finished it this time around. So anyway, more on the reasons for that later. Let's get on to the universe of the book. This is actually a little bit tricky to set up just while talking, because there's different planes of existence in this universe, and there's this very high energy level above ours where time runs really quickly and information flows really quickly, and aliens live there, and they live on some kind of distorted space-time around the singularity at the centre of the universe. And they call themselves, they live on the range, they call it the range, and they're called Rimstalkers in the book or something. Again, it's not really exactly made clear where they're actually from or what they're doing there or how they exist or anything like that. And then there's our level of existence. Us humans, though, have died out billions and billions of years ago. And there's this spider-like species, this alien species called the Zotl, spelled Z-O-T-L. So Zotl or Zudult or whatever it is. And they seem to have taken over big parts of the universe. And the Zotl, for some reason, not explained very well in the book at all, they feed off of pain. So apparently there's some kind of energy force that conscious beings excrete when they are in pain, and the Zotl need that to live. Again, it's not really that well explained in the book at all. Another thing that Zotl do is tap into this higher energy plane, into the range, to draw power. Unfortunately, this kills the people who live there, the aliens who live up on the range, the Rimstalkers. And yeah, they're all dying off. So the people on the range want to stop the Zotl. Again, another thing that isn't actually explained is how the Zotl are technologically advanced enough to tap into the energy around the singularity in the centre of the universe, but they're not advanced enough to work out a way to produce fake pain juice. Yeah, none of that's explained at all. So the aliens on the range, they send one soldier called Gear, and she's sent down to our energy level, all of existence, to sort of build a trap to kill the Zotl. And that's pretty much where the book, or that sort of sets up the world that the book exists in. This is explained in the first few chapters of the book. So I'm not really spoiling anything here at all. Other stuff that you find out quite quickly is that the spaceship that Gia uses to shed her high energy and get down to our energy level, it turns out that it's a whole solar system. And it's got a sun, and it's got a black hole, and it's got like 14 or 15 planets. And it'll take 7,000 human years, or seven ages, as they're called in the book. And in that time, Gia has to sort of find a bait for the trap, which turns out to be humans, of course, and get as many Zotl into the trap as possible, and then find this magical ode, or oode, again, the pronunciation of this word isn't quite that clear. And that secretly, not ever explained how, it kills the Zotl. And then she has to send the oode to the homeworld of the Zotl and kill them all there. That's the plan that's set up. And you may be wondering, actually, what the oode may be, you know, but you never actually find out in the book at all. It's just a MacGuffin. It's just sort of sitting there, and you just really don't just never work out what's going on. Another thing that I must mention is that in this solar system, which is this spaceship, the solar system-sized spaceship, there's lots of wormholes, like these portals throughout it. So you can get from one spaceship to another, or one planet in this solar system to another, just walking through these portals. But if you step sideways in the portals, you go forwards or backwards in time. Or something. Again, it's never actually explained why this happens or how this happens or the mathematics behind it or even any theories behind it. You just sort of go, okay, this happens, and you go, okay, if you want it to happen like that, I'll just go with it, okay? There's obviously a number of other characters, human characters in the book as well. As well as following Gia's struggle against the Zotl, we also find the main story is Nedo Tennis and Shanti Beppu, and they're a young couple who are from different cultures who fall in love, but Ned has to go off and fight in a war in his sort of jet fighter spaceship kind of thing against some rebels who are attacking his city. And Ned is chased in his aircraft at high speed, and he escapes by driving into one of these portal wormhole kind of things. And this catapults him sideways back in time, or he goes through wrong and too fast, and he gets shot back in time. Thankfully, Shanti has given him a homing device, and so she sets off to find him on this epic journey through space and time, throughout the seven ages, the 7,000 years of the life of this fake solar system that's been set up. And Ned encounters Gia at various times in the story, and interesting things happen. And there's lots of things about this book that I like, and lots of things that I don't like. Probably more things about this book that I don't like than like. The story itself is interesting places, but just really stupid, and lots of other places, just dumb. And the worst thing is that overall, it made no sense. You know, the initial idea is amazing. There's a spaceship from a higher energy level, and it arrives here, and it's got so much energy left over, it builds and maintains an entire solar system. Great. But the author, Atanasio, or whatever his name is, he just seems to wing it for the rest of the book. He sets up a great situation, but then it's just like, it's just random where he goes from there. It's like he doesn't know what's going to happen at the end of the book, or hasn't plotted anything out. So for example, Gia, our alien hero, she doesn't know what's going on at all. So she makes a plan, and then she breaks it just a few hundred years later, or in the next age, she just goes back against her plan, and you're like, okay, what's happening here? She orders her, like, artificial intelligence machines to do one thing, and then, you know, she orders them to do something different, like in the next age. And it feels just like there's no consistent goal. You know, for any success, she needs to find the oode. But in the whole book, there's maybe, I'm not kidding here, maybe 4 or 5 pages given over to her search for the oode. And it's the most important thing in the book. It's the only reason why she's come across into our plane of existence and our energy level. And she just doesn't even bother looking for it. She just sort of like goes, I'll send this person off to look for it. I'll send this person to look for it. It's just really weird. It's like hardly explored at all. And the book is just filled with this kind of stuff. It's not just that the characters are confused and they don't know what they're doing. Like I say, the author doesn't know what's, you know, technical details. He just sort of makes them up when it's needed in the plot. Like, for example, one point, or throughout the first half of the book, Ned, our human hero, he's afraid to go through this portal in case he sort of like gets sucked back into the future and then overshoots in the future. And when he gets back there, Shanti, who he thinks is just staying back at his own time, you know, she's going to grow up and grow old and die before, you know, when he gets there. So he doesn't want to go too quickly in case he overshoots. But then it said, oh, but the theory is that if you overshoot, then the next time you go through the portal, you start going backwards in time until you overshoot. And then you sort of yo-yo backwards and forwards past your own time until you settle back into your own original timeline again. And then it goes, but we're not quite sure. So you set it up and you think, oh, that's the reason why he's being careful, just going straight back to his own time in case he overshoots. But then when it gets back to his own time, he doesn't only shoot. And it's just explained, it's like, well, that doesn't happen after all. And they all just accept it, that there's this sort of all this time travel thing set up and it's never been experimented with. And we're just left in ignorance. And the characters in the book, even, you know, Gia, who set this whole thing up, and her spaceship, she doesn't even know how it works. And she doesn't use it in any way. It's just sort of like this really crap plot device. And again, another thing is, like, there's this character that dies, and it's a character that you care about. He's quite a cool guy, one of my favorite characters in the book, and he's been traveling with Shanti on a quest to find Ned. And suddenly when he dies, it's like, oh, he's dead, and we get all the tension out of the situation from him dying, and you feel really sorry for him. And then in the next chapter, or in the next few paragraphs, it just goes, oh, and he looked down his body and he's a ghost. And suddenly ghosts exist in this universe. They've never been mentioned up to now, and now there's ghost. And then someone else dies and he hangs out with the first guy. And then someone else dies and he just hangs out. So in the history of this whole universe, ghosts aren't mentioned at all. And suddenly the author wants to keep a character about who's died. And then, bingo, ghosts. And there's many, many more things that got to me. Oh, one of the main things is, how do humans get to be here a billion years after they've been extinct? Well, apparently, when someone dies, their mind is converted into a light wave or something, which isn't really explained. And then a machine can capture this information encoded in this light wave, and then Gia's spaceship can recreate this body out of the ground and insert the human mind into it. And then you've resurrected a clone of someone who just died billions of years before. And that's how humans get from 2 billion years ago to the present, or the present in the book. And I was just reading this, I was thinking, well, this is a bit strange, because then if anybody dies, you can just look for this wave pattern in the universe and just resurrect them again, because you can just make their body again, and that's it. No tension. Doesn't matter if someone dies. Doesn't matter if someone gets flung back thousands of years into the past. You could just find where they died a few thousand years in the past, get this information out of the ether, and get them again. And I was just like, okay, that's obviously not, you can't obviously just do it randomly, take people out the air, or sort of like in the random people sort of floating around and as a light wave in the universe. You can't just go, oh, I'll find that person. And you can't just do that. But then apparently later in the book, they do that. Someone dies and they just resurrect them again. I'm just like, oh, where's the tension here? It doesn't matter if anyone dies. You can just grab their mind energy back from the book again. Actually, one second. I made a note here in my notes about where this is explained in the book. Let me just find it here. Okay. Page 88. Here we go. The DNA, people are talking to each other. This is sort of like the exposition bit here. The DNA antenna in every living being transmit the waveform of that being during its lifetime. When it dies, its transmission ends, but the waveform persists in the vacuum indefinitely. You do recall that light has no rest mass, and therefore is not subject to diminishment over time. Individual photons are extincted only when they actually come into contact with matter, but matter is so extremely tenuous out here in the vacuum that most light will never touch matter during the entire lifetime of the universe. And then it goes on to say, but, you know, I can't remember, here it goes. Oh, yeah, let me remind you, space-time is a manifold. Think of it as a tesseract, a four-dimensional cube. Yes, light propagates through space, but also through time. And I'm like, does it? But it just states it there in the book, and I'm just like, okay, light goes through space, but also through time. So people who die in the past, they stick around all indefinitely into the future, and people who die in the future stick around indefinitely into the past? Or does it only go one way? Again, no rules are actually set up here, and that's what really, really gets to me. So it all comes down to, yeah, pretty much what it comes down to is that there's no rules. When somebody wants to do something, say someone's in a lot of peril, and you think, wow, they're in a lot of peril here, they're never going to fight against the evil Zottel here, and they're never going to get out. Suddenly they just go, and then, using some kind of high energy, Gia did this and did that and transported a monster and they battled a thingy. And it even says that at one point. It just goes, using some form of energy, she just does it. And I'm like, oh. So disappointing. If the rules of physics that were in place at the end of the book happened to be in place at the beginning of the book, nothing in the book would have happened, because they'd have just gone, oh, we know the physics of the book here, but they changed that the book, so you never really know what's going on. So for the story and the consistency of the universe, I'd give it maybe 1 out of 5, or maybe 0.5 out of 5, just for that sort of like the execution of the story within the universe that's set up at the beginning of the book. Things I liked about the book, though, is actually the minor characters. There's this school teacher called Tully Gunther who gets enslaved in a Zottle sort of biological robot thing. And it makes no sense at all what he's doing there. He has no function except his struggle is quite interesting to read. And there's some old men in the book, one called Spoonie Yegg and one called Nappy Groth. And they're the travelling companions of Chanti. And also Ned O'Tennis's travelling companion from ancient Indonesia or Malaysia or wherever he comes from. He was quite an interesting guy as well. And also the artificial intelligence that Gia brings along with her, parts of her spaceship, who inhabit the sun and the black hole in the solar system that she creates. Those guys, yeah, also quite interesting too. I also quite like the plotting of the story throughout the seven ages of the solar system, because the book actually opens in age 4,000 years after the creation of the universe. And, you know, there's Ned and Chanti and they get together in the fourth age. But they speak of these ages, you know, beforehand as legends, you know, and the creator is like a god. In fact, Ned, he's actually a creationist skeptic. He doesn't believe that the solar system is unnatural, that it was created by an alien thing. And Chanti, she's a believer in creationism. And in this case, in the book, the creationists are actually right. There is some kind of godlike being out there who created everything that they know. And then we actually skip back to the first age, you know, because Ned O'Tennis gets flipped back there. And we then follow the story of Gia from the beginning. And they're sort of their stories, you know, they intertwine along the way. And again, the massive time travel paradoxes throughout the book, which aren't explained at all. But the whole thing is really well done. I like how she weaves, the author weaves the story of Gia and Ned O'Tennis and the other characters together. Like, for example, Ned is doing something. Oh, no, it starts off like, say, a chapter begins, or the age, this sort of age of the book will begin. And the author tells like a story of a legend. This person did this and they did this and they were fighting this person. They went into the portals here and they got attacked by the portals and he stepped sideways by accident and lost himself. And other people did this and then other people went to find them. And there's some like epic sort of traveling heroes on a quest. And our heroes sort of spot them along the way. It's like, oh, you know, he walks past this person and sees these three people in the distance. And those three people are sort of Chanti and Nappy Groth and other people. And Nappy Groth goes, oh, there's those heroes back that I heard about when I was here. And I really just like how the narrative sort of flows seamlessly from like these legendary stories into our main character storyline, and you realize that in the future these people's storylines are going to be legends that are told in the last few ages, you know, the last ages of the solar system. So I really actually quite like that, and it brings a lot of flavor into the world, and it makes the world feel real throughout the entire 7,000 years. Another thing that I really like is because you've got 7,000 years to tell a story, there's lots of ways to weave like large conspiracy theories behind it, which actually turn out to be true. For example, the political situation in Ned and Chanti's home time, about in the fourth age, about 4,000 years in, we presume is quite simple. But then behind the scenes, as you sort of work up to that time, as you follow Gia's story and Ned's story throughout time, you see things that they're not really as they seem. Because, you know, humans are meant to be a bait in the trap, but it turns out humans are sort of kick-ass when it comes to warfare and things, because we're so violent and we're so sort of warlike and tribal in that way, and we can kick ass. But, you know, we're meant to be a bait, so in some cases Gia will sort of assist the Zottle in a way to put down the humans, you know, so they don't wipe out all the Zottle before the trap is ready to spring and before she can send the Ood back to the Zottle homeworld. Again, I'm not really spoiling very much here, but that weaving of the political situation and the alliances between the humans and Gia and the Zottle and how it changes over time, I actually really liked as well. I think, if you take these elements, you take these sort of legendary stories that get told, and you take this sort of political and warfare and all that kind of intrigue, but set it in a universe with consistent rules of physics, I think you could have had a real masterpiece here. Finally, I guess, one other thing that I didn't like, I guess, is at one point this character pops up and you suddenly goes, you can read this person's story in another book by A.A. Atanasio. And I'm like, oh, right. And then that person suddenly becomes a major character in the book for a chapter or so and then disappears again. And I'm like, oh, but I don't know this other book. And it was only at this point where I realised this book is actually the fourth book in a series of four books. And I'm like, oh, maybe all of this makes sense. Maybe all of the physics and all the portals, that's all explained in another book. And I just don't understand what's going on because I haven't read the other book. But again, I wasn't told up until that point, or like in the author's note at the very end, which is a bit bad. Another thing that I really want to complain about, which I've complained about before, I think, on this podcast, is that at the end of the book, why does it so often come down to a hero and they have a gun and the villain has a gun and it just comes down to a firefight at the end? I mean, there's thousands of amazing things like described in this book which could have been used to defeat enemies, some kind of portal trap or this or that, but it always just comes down to, oh, we've got to save the day with a grenade launcher, say. You know, it's just like Arnold Schwarzenegger in the film, I don't know, the one End of Days or Seven, whatever it is, and Arnie goes up against Satan, like the Prince of Darkness, with a rocket launcher, and he wins. He actually manages to kill Satan with a rocket launcher. You're like, what the hell's going on here? It's exactly the same thing in this story, and I think the prefect, I complained about that, and it happens quite a lot of the time. It always just comes down to a firefight between the main baddie and the main hero. Okay, I've been going 20 minutes here. I might as well wrap it up with two more points, I guess, that I wrote down. The writing style. It's obviously aiming to be, like, epic and literary, and there's lots of florid language and grand descriptions of that and overblown use of long words. And when I got the, you know, when I was reading it, because the plot and the technology sort of, they don't have any internal logic, but the language itself doesn't seem to have any fixing point. It's just verbose. Actually, that's exactly the word I'm looking for. It's just verbose, or logorrhea, I guess, is another word to say it. It's just like using words for the sake of using words. It just becomes a joke. You know, there's never like a noun or a verb with at least one or maybe two adjectives. Actually, this will be one of those experimental, pick a page at random and find a good example of this. Okay, here we go. Just flicking here to the end of the book. What page are we on? 393, near the end of the book. It's only 400 pages long, this book. So here he goes. I don't want to say what people are saying, so I'll just read the bits between. Okay. The weed woman's knobbly fingers held up a blackened coin. She pointed to a corroded door that was open a crack. And then a bit later, the warmth that had come around his heart went cold, and he jolted towards the monolithic door. Ned O'Tennis ignored her and ran hard to meet the risks of his fate. And it's just like, wait a second, so you've got a blackened door, and suddenly it becomes, what was it, a monolithic door. And it's just like, just get over it. They're just, these words just crammed in there. It's just unbelievable all the way through. It's just like, that's just sort of like from one little part of the book there. But it's just like all the time, just, yeah. What does it say? Verbose. Logorrhea, Rick. I don't know that word, because I'm not a logorrhearist. What was I going to say there? Oh, yeah. Clever turns of phrase are good now and then, but don't try to cram four or five of them into every sentence. You know, ran hard to meet the risks of his fate. It's just like, oh, for goodness sake. Finally, the themes of the book. At the end, I didn't really care what the author was trying to say. It just becomes just a crap sort of adventure through time. If the story had stopped about 300 pages in, it was really good up until that point. But then it's like the author wanted to push things forward so it doesn't just happen in the past up until the fourth age. Like the finale of the book has to happen at the end of the seventh age of the solar system. And for that past, the last 100 pages, it just goes all over the place. What was I saying? Oh, yeah, the themes of the book. Author's postscript. Here we go. Last page. Page 407. The last thing that you read. It goes, the last Legends of Earth is the final volume in a series I call the Radix Tetrad. My intention has been to thematically structure each novel around one of the four cardinal dimensions that define us and our world. Height, depth, width, and time. And for this one, it goes, finally, here in the last Legends of Earth, language and individual character flatten before the inexorable mystery of change that we call time. So it's obviously meant to be a book all about time, but if you're going to do a book about time, you've got to have a clue about time. You've got to have like an overall understanding of what time is. And in this book, I just don't feel that at all. It just goes all over the place. Paradoxes here, paradoxes there. I guess it does get the whole sort of like, okay, the change of time and humans compared to the passage of time is sort of like mysterious and we don't really know what happens in the past. Yet you do get that. And like how people in the past, they're just going about their business and they become like mysteries in the end. But again, it's just like you don't get to play with time if you just do random shit with it, and there's plot holes all over the place. If you want to do clever stuff with time, you've got to work out something clever. There's got to be consistent rules throughout. I saw the film, the Futurama DVD release, Bender's big score or something. And they at least had some rules there. You know, it was all over the place, but there were some rules. And they had something to say about time travel paradoxes and all that kind of stuff in a clever way. But here in this book, it's just all over the place. So overall, I'm going to give this book like 2 stars out of 5 because there was a good stuff in this book. And I did enjoy reading parts of it. But in the end, it became a joke. Just sort of like pick out the plot holes, pick out the florid use of language for no reason. And as you go along, and it's just like, oh, it's all over the place. So only read this book if you're a big fan of A.A. Attanasio. Maybe you've read the other books in the series and you want to finish off the Tetrad, as it's called. Only get the book then. Or if you like verbosity, I guess you could get the book then too. The next book that I'm going to read is called Black Man, and it's by Richard Morgan. And because I started reading this a while ago, I've actually almost finished it already. So the next podcast should probably be up in a few days. So I'm enjoying the book again. I have some complaints, one big complaint, which is the same as the complaint of this book, and the same complaint that I had in the previous book by Spider Robinson, but I'll go into that more in the next podcast as well. So keep sending in your book ideas. I've got some good ones. Someone sent in, hey, how about John Varley? I think it's John Varley with Red Thunder or something, so I picked up that book, and other people have suggested some books as well, so they've gone to the back of the list. Keep sending in your book suggestions, either at luke@juggler.net, or go to the wiki on the sfbrp.com wiki kind of thing and add your book suggestions to the future book suggestions page there. So thanks for listening and catch you later.